So, Maria, did you enjoy your butter biscuit?
Yes.
You did. Okay, you're still half digesting that. AI made this pod. What a terrifically grim statement from the 21st century. You've probably seen on YouTube and other platforms that AI made this log. AI made this video. AI has made this mashup of what Oasis would sound like today if they're still making music. And here we are playing the game. This, in a sense, this podcast was designed by AI and we're doing its bidding, which is probably a fateful portent of things to come in the future. And in this grim podcast, I welcome Maria. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very angry as well.
Great. Listeners would love hearing to that. So let's define what we mean by AI made this pod. So of course, you've probably seen ChatGPT 4.0 is the newest model. We don't pay for premium, so we've used ChatGPT 3.5, which is the next best thing. And I asked the AI, give us three ideas for a podcast. And it got back to me with something about the future, interview some experts, we won't be interviewing any experts, something about hidden stories of your city, interview an expert, we won't be interviewing any experts, but we will tell you interesting things about the city, this is what we do in our tour anyway. And then the third thing was about architecture and building in your city. Also interview an expert, which we're not going to do. We're going to just talk between ourselves about those three topics. So we have the future, architecture, and hidden stories. So AI has devised this structure for us, but as free-thinking humans, we have gone out and investigated, and we'll give our thoughts and opinions in due course as well. You're angry, but come on, don't be such a buzzkill for the listeners. Tell us something. Why are you angry?
Well, no, I'm just fed up of like PT. XYZ. They're just like, it's just everywhere now, and it's just, I'm sure it's a fad, you know, but, and you're saying it devised a podcast, but it just gave three titles or three things that we've talked about in the past anyway. And we developed all the content, so it's just, you know, business as usual for us.
Well, I have, you know, I did start off this introduction with a sideways glance at the whole thing, but there was which the listeners couldn't really enjoy, but I think the results have been quite poor, haven't they, so far? Because on one hand, a kid could write an essay and or even pass the bar. That's what I saw today. You could pass the New York bar exam and become a lawyer in New York using ChatGPT. So it has that facility. Has some limited reasoning, but again, you know, these mashups of what Oasis would sound like, or they did a version of write a song like Nick Cave. And it's a very crude imitation of someone as complex and talented, as skilled as Nick Cave is. So it has a long ways to go, it seems. Bit of an Americanism there, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think we probably don't have to fear for our futures just yet. But yeah, I think it's definitely a fad, isn't it? People are kind of, it's just easy content for people like us and everybody else. But we're going to make it interesting, put our own spin on it. But it just seems to be kind of grabbing people's attention because for good and for bad, it's potentially signposting the end of our civilization, but also... we can do
for good or for bad. What's the good part about it?
That's the bad part.
We're not gonna lie.
That's the bad part. The good part is it's a bit of a laugh. So balances
hell
out.
Yeah.
You know. So before we really properly jump into this,
we have a laugh. Destruction.
Before we properly jump into this, is there anything else you want to say about this, or should we kind of go through the topics one by one?
We can go through the topics and pretend that GPT has helped us with this.
Right, okay, so let's... I'm very interested to start with Seoul because I actually learned something. So for people who don't know Madrid, Seoul is the centre of the city. And the universe, if you're...
No, it's the centre of Spain, in reality.
Well, I was going to say this because you can find kilometer zero. Yeah.
Sí.
there, which is where everything, all the measurements from Spain radiate from this point. And yeah, it's an amazing plaza, which hasn't changed so much over the years. However, you did send me something yesterday, which I was quite surprised about. If you could stop rustling papers, that would be lovely.
I'm not rustling, it's just going to fly away and then make more noise.
AI doesn't need papers, that's one advantage over you as a co-host.
Why are you printing?
Because I'm using my phone to record this. So it hasn't changed that much, but you did send me something yesterday.
I did.
Which kind of showed Sol in a new way. Could you kind of walk us through that a little bit?
It was just something I found on like the town hall website. It's not very good. Normally it just gives like very brief descriptions of the main touristic places, but this I thought was interesting. Well, the description was interesting for two reasons. One, it had all the changes that this last refurbishment was going to, you know, imply, of which they haven't really done even half of them. So that was interesting because they forgot to delete it. So you can check what things they promised they would do and they haven't done. And also they had this reconstruction from, History Museum or the archive. Yeah, I think it was the city archive. Just basically with different models and things like that, they recreated what the square looked like in the 1830s.
Yeah. 50s,
maybe.
And you can, it's 360, you can move around it, but it seemed a lot narrower. Just optics or?
I think it might be optics. I think the main difference is that it was like, and in fact in the text, it refers to it in the 19th century as a wide street, a wide passage, as it doesn't call it so much a square. And in fact, I mean, it's called Puerta del Sol, like it's called door, it's not really called, and there's a reason for that, I can tell you if you want. But yeah, it was, okay, fine, might as well. It's supposed to be called like Puerta del Sol because in the 16th century, when the place was kind of, it was outside the city, really, even though now it's smack in the center. So they built a fortress, because it was a local war. They built a fortress and there was a door, and apparently that door had a sun on it, carved on it, and presumably because it was facing east, that's why they put a sun. So now it's called the Sun Door.
Wow, very beautiful. Quite moved by that. As people, long-time listeners of the podcast will know, we do go to a lot of old photographic exhibitions or exhibitions about old photographs. Sol is strangely absent from a lot of these pictures. But then when you do see it, you just kind of marvel at how it's the same, more or less. You know, there might be, here's a painting of the introduction of electric light in Sol, which is a beautiful painting in the History Museum in Tribunal. Or you might see here the tram lines that are put down, and they've been taken up. And maybe they'll be put down again, because that's what happens with countries. No, tram lines went out of fashion and now they're putting them back in again, like in Dublin with the Lewis. So Sol in its constancy is remarkable, but strangely absent, I think, from the great stories of the city, even though, of course, I'm sure it has a lot of history in it as well. You're giving me that look, but you know what I mean. People, like, there's Ventas where there's political rallies, or there's people on Gran Via, or there's a lot of photographs that, in my impression, that other parts of the city stand out more in that tapestry of photographs. I'm not saying there's not history in Sol, but I'm just saying from the visual things that we've seen. But the reason I'm kind of bringing this up is because until recently, the biggest controversy around Sol that I knew from all my time living here for the last 10 years was the Tio Pepe sign, when it was originally on one particular building in the square, and then they put on another one, and people are like, that's not historical, they had to put on where it was, you know. But there's actually a huge controversy now about what they've been doing in Sol. So I mean, it's kind of interesting, you know, we spoke about Joseph Roth before on a previous podcast. He writes about Berlin in the 20s and 30s, and there's huge chapters about the roadworks and the building going on around the city of Berlin. And I feel like I'm living that in Madrid. Ever since I've been here, they've just been digging up huge tracts of the city. Gran Via, until recently, And also just off the centre of Seoul also. More recently, they've been doing works that cost 80 million euro. Architect contact of mine told me that the architect who was responsible for it is actually very well renowned. But some people are complaining about it. Nothing really much has changed, I would say. But you're kind of the quasi-local, so maybe you can pick up the story here. Why is this in the news? Why people are talking about it? What's been happening?
Well, just to recap on what you've said, it's interesting what you're saying about the photographs, how it's more absent, because literally every, big political thing or social uprising even that has happened, or it happened there. And it's also got a huge significance to do with, like, the 15M, you know, with the social protests. When there was the Arab uprisings, there was, like, some sort of protest here as well. The Republic, Second Republic was proclaimed there. You know, all these fights that we're talking about and all these battles in Napoleonic times, for example, happened there as well. And I think, well, it's interesting what you say about, you know, featuring. I've never given it that much thought, but it's true. Perhaps it's just less easy to photograph, you know, being a square. I don't know. I don't really know. But, for example, the ones of the Republic are really famous. But, yeah, you almost cannot tell that it's there for how many people there are there. Obviously, New Year, every year we celebrate there. So
also, there's that one time two guys who dressed up as Hello Kitty and SpongeBob SquarePants started knocking two blocks off each other and went very viral.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, all sorts of things have happened there. but no, it's interesting what you say, because I think it sort of sums up what the square is. The fact that it's very meaningful and also not meaningful at all. I think it's a constant through history, because, as I say, the biggest things have happened there. But then at the same time, well, you say there's not much photographic record. And also, like, the buildings, apart from like one or two, have stayed there consistently from the 19th century. But then the actual things in it is what has been changing over the course of time. So there hasn't been much respect. There are certain elements that have been, you know, they've played around with even now that live inside the square. But yeah, they haven't cared very much about the shape or about keeping its character beyond the famous clock. So, and I think probably the biggest proof of that is the latest refurbishment, where basically they've just turned it into a desert where there's absolutely no shades. And you know, that's how you were talking when we were preparing this. You were talking about how the place or GPT gave us the idea of how places change and we think about them in different ways and all this. And this is certainly one of those cases, because I explained about the door before, but nowadays people make jokes that it's called like that because it's just, you know, it's just sun. It's just pure sun. There's no shades. And in the summer, it's going to be absolutely scorching even more than it is now. So,
well, that is relevant, though, isn't it? Because, first of all, we will talk about the drought in Spain. The rain in Spain does not fall mainly on the plain.
Or anywhere else, for that matter.
Because of climate change, but yeah. Which will be relevant later. But also, people, the aforementioned men dressed up, and women sometimes dressed up as characters in these big furry suits. Hmm. They wear woolly hats sometimes underneath their heads, because if they sweat a lot, it can make the material of the costume shrink or expand. And then you have the unsay lottery sellers, you have the other people who are on the street. So, yeah, Seoul is essentially an oven where there's no respite from the heat. And it kind of just begs the question, what do they spend the money on? Because in honor of it not changing so much, in some respects, it hasn't changed at all from pre-refurbishment to post-refurbishment. It hasn't, you know, it's not fundamentally different, I would say.
Well, they've just cleared the middle, basically, which means there's just no shade. And then for some reason they decided to turn around the horse, like there's a statue of Charles III on a horse, and they just put it so that when you walk in from Plaza Mayor towards Seoul, which is the natural route for tourists to follow. The first thing you see is just the horse backside, which is kind of bizarre.
Lovely sight, to be fair. Now, Sol, you know, it is where Real Madrid, I guess, Atletico come when they win trophies. I know they have Cibeles and Duno, but also there's they go to the balcony of the town council there as well. But also, what's interesting for me is because there, when you live in Spain, sometimes you see TV shows about the Franco period, and you get a sense of the repression that was there. But you have an anecdote about your parents, no? Walking past that very building where now they present the players after winning a title, that in there, in the bowels of that building, sometimes you could hear the screams of people being tortured, no? That's more or less
the idea. Yeah, because in the dictatorship, the general headquarters of the police, of what was called the social and political police, was there. So in there was obviously like in the basements and dungeons where people got tortured. And yeah, I mean, pretty recent, because I remember my mom mentioning that as he walked past, like hearing, and we're talking maybe, you know, the 60s. Of course, as we were saying before, a lot of things have happened there. But it also goes to show like how some things are deleted of the city, because those dungeons that, of course, are not used for that anymore, but you used to be able to see them. And then one of the times that they tarmac the place, they just block them and they're no longer there.
We were going to record this podcast in Sol today, but I have a dodgy boiler, so I didn't want to be too far from home. And also,
sounds like some euphemism for like diarrhea or something.
the pipes aren't working. But also, where we are, this is known as the Seven Hills, colloquially as the Seven Tits. We'll just get age restricted for that. But it's also an example of a place that's changed, because these Seven Hills used to be rubbish tips, and they got paved over with grass. That's the wrong verb, but essentially covered with grass, and now they're hills. So it just shows how the city has changed. And speaking of the photographs, to go into a loop here, to connect some threads, you know, we have seen photographs of Vallecas from the 50s and stuff like that. And it's always amazing to me how the edges of Madrid a short time ago, relatively speaking, were the edges of Madrid. Now it's just, okay, it's not the center, but there's a lot more Madrid.
It's going
beyond
to be soon enough, because they're just, you know, making
gentrification.
Well, the M30, they're turning into a huge garden that is going to extend all the way to Vallecas. I was reading about it today.
Yeah, well, actually, I was watching a video on YouTube. So there's a place called Pacifico, which is close to here, where they knocked the bridge down, and it was really unfortunate, because underneath that bridge they had a skating park and all these wonderful resources. You could play basketball there, and it's a really kind of great way to use and utilize this kind of very specific urban place. But that's gone, of course.
I've just realized it's gone. Like, I drive past there all the time, and I've just realized it, right?
But I actually was watching a guy, like, he's a YouTuber, a travel blogger, and he came across a bridge, like, oh, it's a cool bridge. Maybe they could use this for something, you know? And I was thinking, well, we had that in Pacifico, but now, unfortunately, it's gone. So that's architecture taken care of. The other thing we could talk about was the hidden stories of Madrid, of which we're well versed, and we should take this opportunity to thank our American friends who joined us on a tour last weekend and left us a very nice review. They said we were too cheap, we should be more expensive. So I think we'll take that under consideration and raise our prices 3, 4, or even 5-fold. You know, this is the last time I'll mention this, we were on national radio talking about the tour. But one thing that wasn't covered on that was the our stop at the Taberna Antonio Sanchez, which is probably one of the oldest bars in Madrid, if not the oldest. Whenever you look at old maps, you can see a building there. It's called Antonio Sanchez because it was founded, believe it or not, by a man called Antonio Sanchez, who was a bullfighter, painter, and a bar owner, and wasn't very good at any of those things. But he spent too much time drinking on the wrong side of the bar, it seems. But as a consequence of his passions, his bar did become when he was working there and owning it, but also for a long time after, until the 20th century even as well, became a hub for bullfighters. It was briefly the headquarters of the Swedish Bullfighting Association. I always mention this in the tour and I have no idea why it is or
people
was.
People kind of like that fact.
Yeah, it's so random.
Surprises
that's why.
Everybody.
But it's also been just a place for painters and writers to go to. It's absolutely amazing. So there's obviously so much we can talk about this, but the facade is quite nice. On the outside, if you ever go there in Madrid, you'll see a very short phone number. It's one of the original phone numbers out there. The church would actually buy their wine there to get consecrated. They sold tarikas for like 2 cents or whatever, 2 pesetas. And King Alfonso XIII, the great king of Spain, used to order quite regularly for his breakfast from that bar as well. But do you know what my favourite fact, Maria, is about that bar?
Tell me, Enda.
I'm glad you asked. So essentially, when the French came to town in the War of Spanish Succession, they invaded Spain as a pretext. They said like, oh, our troops are in Portugal, so we have to go through Spain to get to them. But it was really just an excuse to take over Spain as well. The British helped push the Spanish back, or the French out of Spain. And in this conflict, three friends from Tirso de Molina, very close to the bar, killed some French soldiers. Running and fearing for their lives, they went into the cellar of this bar, jumped inside, and hid until the coast was clear. This story spread quite quickly around the city, and after the French were conquered, defeated, and pushed out of the country, Viva España, people went to that bar to drink specifically that wine and toast the freedom of Spain as well.
Wow.
Thank you.
I'm just pretending I've never heard that story before.
I'm holding out a digital cap so people can put in digital tips as well. But no, honestly though, Ernest Hemingway was there. But then again, as we always say in the tour, what bar in Spain wasn't he in?
Exactly.
Pierre Baroja, he was a great man from the barrio as well, who wrote about working class people in a very masculine style, if that makes sense. A very Hemingway style. That's why they liked each other. In fact, they had a big love in that bar. I love you. You're a great writer. I think you're great. You're smashing. And the great master of life, Sorolla, painted a portrait of Baroja. And they actually had their meeting there as well, because Baroja drank there, but also Sorolla chose it as his watering hole as well, quite frequently. And then we have people like Gloria Fuertes, who I can talk about as well. But, you know, Gloria Fuertes, she was a woman, as yourself. She was a writer, big into literacy and hosting loads of events like we do as well. So growing up in Spain, Gloria Fuertes, was she an influence, inspiration? You can say no, don't worry.
No, it's just like she was particularly famous for like children's poems. So when I was growing up, she was always identified with children's poems and like silly rhymes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then it's only like recently that they've started to focus more on her life and her work for adults as well.
Well, it's quite interesting. She was involved with the Poetismo, Generación 50, Verses with Skirts would be another one. And a real pioneer in organizing cultural events around the barrio, around the neighborhood. But also, what else can we say about this bar? Oh, yes, if you do like her, or you kind of like get to know about her after listening to this podcast, heaven forbid we actually influence people to read more about the things we talk about. If you go to the bar, the thing is, it's a heritage site, so it's a working bar. You can go in and have a beer there. But nothing's been changed. So it has the same zinc counters, the same signs telling you not to spit, the same bull heads on the walls.
No light bulb.
Thankfully not. And she would sit in the same corner all the time, dipping her bread into wine. She would just be there in the corner doing that. And if you are a fan of her, you can go and sit where she sat and imagine writing, or her writing. It's quite a nice thing you can do. Obviously, people who heard our national radio tour thing. Okay, that's the last time I mentioned that. It's not the only stop in the tour where you can see the original implements, because, of course, in the hairdressers, the original implements are there as well. So it's just a quite historic pub, bar. Beautiful wood paneling on the outside and beautiful interior on the inside as well, all as it has always been, for example. We've had a few drinks there. We've enjoyed it. So I don't know. I mean, of all our stops in the tour, every stop has a hidden stories and things. That's the whole point of it. But I mean, do you? Since this is, I mean, this is my stop. I always talk about it, mm-hmm, so I actually have no idea how you feel about this bar and its legacy.
No, I think it's interesting because obviously there's a few really old restaurants or bars in Madrid, but it's just nice, you know, that the facade has been preserved. And what I like the most about that is the fact that it's got the original signs, as you said, with the price and with the original telephone number. It just makes you think how much things have changed and evolved. So I think it is quite charming. I mean, I wouldn't pick it as a place to overdrink on the inside, really, beyond its cultural significance. But again, you would expect tastes to change throughout the century.
But it's good in a sense, because if you go there, they're kind of cool with you just checking it out as a historical site, because there are a few other places in the city that are historical bars where Hemingway has drank as well, and they've dusty bottles in the back, and again, it hasn't changed. It's not as historic as this one, but they're historic, and like, they just hate if you're a tourist. Like, you have to go in there and drink and almost ignore the stuff that's there, but then it's on display, so it's kind of a catch-22 situation. So some places, they are historical bars, but they don't like you really treating it as such. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know. In the end, these are kind of like tourist traps always. So prices are always ridiculous. But I guess the advantage is it's not just smack in the middle of Sol or Plaza Mayor. You know, it's a little bit, obviously, Lavapiés and Tirso de Molina and Domardili still within the tourist area, but not quite so much. So perhaps that's also what's safety from becoming, you know, Pizza Hut or something.
Okay, well, we've exhausted that. So what we'll do is we'll go to part two, the interlude. And then after that, we'll have a more extended discussion about artificial technology and the future and really meaty stuff before we let you go and enjoy the rest of your lives after this episode. And we're back. So we've come to our final ChatGPT 3.5 topic, which is the future. And we've taken
it.
I was just literally going to say that. I think we've taken definitely a broader approach to that than maybe was suggested by AI. But we're going to talk about AI, how it affects fashion. I'm a fashionista. Dedicated follower of fashion.
Not really.
How, as well, the future can also, you know, about the environment, of course. Food is going to be an interesting one, but also this moral panic, for better or for worse, about AI. What it all means, for example, and our kind of conclusions about that. That's going to be on the menu for part three. Let's talk about food first. That not specifically linked to AI. All right, is that what you want to do? Food or something else?
No, that's more than fine.
Okay, so let's talk about food. It's not specifically linked to AI, but it is talk about the future of the city we're living in Madrid, and it applies to the future of many cities, really. But there are like workshops happening at the moment with different organizations talking about what will Madrid look like in 2030. Not that very far, not that far away, really. Mm. So they're talking about, right now in 2023, we have Madrid's first vegan butcher, believe it or not. And we're going to be talking about insects, the stuff that you talk about in your book, The Stuff of Life, as well. I was researching this, of course, because that's what else would you do before a podcast? But insects have actually a very rich lineage and culture. So, for example, obviously, we know in Asian countries today they're quite popular. We probably know as well that they're great for protein and very healthy, because if you have a hamburger, it's like 18% protein, 80% fat, but with insects it's like all protein and very little fat. It's absolutely amazing. But the Romans used to eat it, They had lots of recipes. Pliny wrote recipe books about it. Not recipe books per se, but he did have recipes. And Native Americans as well have got. There's been records about them chasing crickets. In fact, I have a bit of a passage here in my paper, my magic paper. So basically, Native Americans dug a series of large trenches, covered them with straw, then drove hordes of crickets into the excavated trap. The Indians would then set that on fire, burning the crickets alive. Then the Native American women gathered the bushels of the charred bugs and brought them back to camp to make flour or bread, an important seasonal source of protein. I'm kind of the human version of ChatGPT, because if you ask this question to ChatGPT, it would just harvest this from the internet, which is essentially what I've done here as well. And also we can see that in China, beekeepers are virile, or considered virile, because they eat bee larvae. That gives them big willies, apparently. Is that disrespectful? I don't know. And then in the West, the onset of farming meant that insects were seen as pests. I think it was interesting. There's a cultural reason for why in the West we aren't so au fait with eating insects. But the Dutch, as open-minded as they are, or sometimes are at least, there are certain movements there trying to combine insects with chocolate. So that's a bit of a potted history, patchy history of insects and their cultural significances. But I know from my straw poll of asking students down through the years about impossible burgers and no meat burgers, as a concept, people are very often repulsed by the idea, even when they shouldn't be, really, I would imagine. Now, as somebody who's studied sustainability and written stuff of life and everything as well, insects of the future, how we eat our food is changing. I know we've spoken about this on another podcast as well, but what else can you add to this topic? You know, the future, Madrid 2030, will it be substantially different from now? Probably not, but 2040, sure. 2050, I mean, how we eat has to radically change, I imagine.
Most likely, yes, of course. But I think it's always the same, you know. People just don't like change. They're scared of change. And I talk about this in the book, that a lot of the time it's not change. It's like, you know, going back to the past and things that were done and then were lost. In reality, when you think about it, a lot of the traditions, for example, that we have now, or like habits, they were only developed like in sort of Victorian times, you know, 19th century and 18th century at the most, and many things that were done before have been lost. And nowadays as well, that, you know, the whole world is connected, and many cultures do things that we don't expect. I mean, if you ask like anybody, even within Europe, people find it very strange that we eat, you know, for example, octopus. There are countries where they think it's very strange that we eat octopus, or thistles, for example, which we eat as a, also is a very traditional, you know, veg in Spain to have. Mm-hmm. But when you say, you know, in an English-speaking country that you eat thistle, they're like, what? In my experience, anyway. So, but those things, I mean, if we don't find them so strange when we start trying things from other countries and other cuisines that we don't have in our own, then I can't see why it should be such a big deal, you know?
Well, you're right to mention the seafood, because I have seen examples of that, people saying, well, we eat insects, but you eat seafood. That's crazy, you know? And in fairness, some seafood can look aesthetically unappetizing in the same way.
Oh, look at like eels, for example. Yeah. Or, you know, that they look like worms. So, yeah, it's all a matter of what people decide to go for. But the people that fear these things are going to fear any other changes as well. So, yeah, I think they just, they think they're trying to push an agenda. But the truth is that we have to be more open-minded as well about, you know, the future of the planet, and just our future, really.
Well, the History Hit YouTube channel with our friend Dan Snow. We've never met him, but we're big fans. He does every so often what the Georgians ate or what the Tudors ate, and it's very revealing. Some things very nice, some things not so nice.
Exactly.
So that hammers home your general point that food changes quite frequently. But even I saw, I think, pictures in The Guardian a few years ago of like post-war Britain food, you know, things people served even up to the 70s, you know, which of course was substantially after the war. But there's things that you wouldn't eat today because they look and sound and were disgusting, you know, just kind of weird combinations. So
I look at spam, like, it looks pretty horrible. Or
yeah, and that's actually still, that's still pretty popular.
Yeah.
So it's quite intriguing. So yeah, the idea is, yeah, we are kind of married to ideas, no, of what is food and what our culture around food is, but actually that does shift quite substantially.
However, very fast as well, even from one generation to the next.
That's it. And trends, I mean, we mentioned this before as well, like in China now, Spanish tapas is kind of like the rich people's food now, and in 10 years it'll be something else, but that's why I never pay for tapas outside of Spain, because it's not a luxury. I'm not going to pay premium prices for this, something I can buy for dirt cheap in Spain. But anyway, and I have to admit though, like, I've seen pictures of like grasshoppers or cockroaches or whatever it is, and it's like there is a mental visual barrier you have to get over to actually eat it, you know, because again, you're not used to it and it just looks pretty rank as well.
Yeah, I think you had a point there with the stuff that you found on the internet, for example. Yeah, when he said that insects were seen as pests, that's quite an interesting thing, because whatever you're not used to and whatever you see as something that you should avoid, then of course, I mean, who's gonna want to eat it?
Yeah, but I'm confused though, because like, look, wasn't agriculture invented in modern day Egypt or Israel?
Oof, let's not get started on that. Sorry, or neither,
didn't know that was appropriately, perhaps, this pun, opening a can of worms there.
Yeah, definitely.
But the broader point is though, it's not just Western civilizations that did agriculture, you know what I mean? So that have an aversion to insects.
Talking thousands of years, so
yeah,
I would have thought the evolution, you know, never mind where agriculture was developed, because by now the way that things have evolved is very different in different places. But we were talking yesterday about tofu.
Yeah.
For example, I mentioned in the book as well, and that was already mentioned even like in Chinese ancient sources. So, but then nowadays we think it's something like brand new that has just been invented for the whole vegetarian stroke, vegan culture or whatever. So yeah, in the end, I think it's just maybe a little bit of ignorance, but now there's no excuse, because obviously we have that information available to us, and we also we should have a sense of how urgent it is to find solutions. I think the only problem is when that gets put forward by politicians as a solution, as a quick fix to avoid, you know, fixing all the problems. So of course, if it's used as a quick fix, that's not going to work. And also not as a substitute of social policies.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting what you say. I think just to circle back to the origins of this just very briefly, I thought it was very interesting that they say potentially our proclivity for eating insects comes from our Neanderthal or Stone Age past, because we saw animals eating them, which gave us the inspiration. Well, maybe we can eat them too. So that could be an interesting origin story. But kind of going back to what you said, about how it could be introduced and it's not a quick fix solution. I think you're right that with food banks, for example, the Conservatives and Tories in England would be very quick to champion those as like a sign that society's pulling together and everything's great, when really they represent the opposite. Not to detract from the good people who are staffing them and feeding people, of course. But I think if the government were to intervene, it surely would have to be about giving money to startups or young business people or new entrepreneurs that want to set up an import business or a restaurant that focuses on that, because that's the only way it can really enter the popular culture or society. Because if those businesses start cropping up, then cultural changes can happen, and then that's how we can kind of filter through society, because it can't come from the top down, you know, really.
Yeah, no, I think you have a point there. But it's definitely something that should be discussed. The problem is, in the end, there's always so much noise with politicians being quick to get these ideas and all these things that are put forward many times by scientists, you know, and people that really study what trends could be like in the future in terms of population, food, and so on. But then, yeah, somebody comes along and just says, oh, well, this is a good way of... And then some of the public reacts saying, well, this is just the woke agenda or whatever, where they just want us to eat, insects and stuff like that. So it's all a vicious circle, I guess, but it's just an important subject to talk about as long as it's done seriously and like with some proper facts as well.
Now, moving on to our next category, from food to fashion, with a brief pit stop with the environment. So there's another movement in Madrid called Fridays for the Future, or Fridays for Future, which I think, just generally speaking, it's interesting to see all the different days that are cropping up. In my local supermarket, from 3 to 4 every day, it's sensory.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, for autistic people, you lower the volume for an hour, and it helps them, I guess. But Madrid's like the loudest city in the world, so I don't think really the reduced volume is anything better.
I'm just laughing at that because, like, literally they have that in Carrefour, and they kind of blast it, like the music is so loud, and they just blast it to tell you that that hour is available.
Yeah.
So, like, if they're already there, it's kind of like the most disturbing thing ever.
Everybody be quiet!
Yeah, no, you know?
But it's an AI. Well, we talk very briefly about these guys. They talk about ecofeminism because the victims of the climate change aren't always equal, reflecting the deep inequalities in our society.
Right.
And also, they have lots of protests and a platform, No More Empty Promises, which, to be fair, is fair enough, because how many times do countries commit to accords or climate promises or goals that are never really ever upheld? But anyway, that's just a brief pit stop into something that's very specifically Madrileño and specifically focused on the future as well. But let's speak more now about fashion. So I was reading recently about how in the 90s in certain shops they had CD-ROMs, so you could kind of see new clothes and spin them around. Very technological for the time. Now, artificial intelligence can, if you're skinny, if you're not so skinny, if you're a water-retaining person, I don't know, whatever your body shape, we celebrate all of them here in the podcast, the AI can generate what that dress or skirt or shirt or football jersey would look on you, for example.
Yeah, but that's not that new, is it? Because, I mean, you know, with makeup, they've been doing it for a while.
Sorry, it's a bird flew next to your head there.
Yeah, they've been doing it for a while. Like, you know, where you could sort of, like, see, have a look and try that shade of, you know, lipstick. See how it will look at you, like, on you. If you upload a photo, and then it never really worked because you're just, like, stupid. But
now
it
it's like, now it's ChatGPT 4. So
it really works.
It's going to work,
oh,
yeah.
Sorry, yeah. I'll have to give it a go, I don't know.
What I think though is interesting is because obviously we have the whole process of fast fashion, and we all know it's a problem. Primark, Zara, etc. But they're saying as well that AI can also can harvest data to predict trends, for example. So, you know, in Spain, in the south, they're going to have this type of, you know, shirts, and they're going to love it, so we'll print an X number of that shirt. In Madrid, it's going to be something else. That's
how
the basic theory.
How do they predict that, though? Like,
big data, deep learning, you wouldn't understand. And also, they're saying that AI can spot problems or solutions better than we can. So, for example, again, in this production process, you know, dyes could get into the river, pollute water, other problems exist as well that maybe make not only the clothes unsustainable, but the whole production process around them. But AI can also problem solve and see, well, actually, we could streamline here, streamline there, make it more efficient, make it greener, and all that kind of stuff. You seem doubtful about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, like, I don't know, now they're selling it like it can do absolutely everything, and at the end of the day, it's like humans putting information in. Although, well, we don't really have time to get into that, but there's the whole discussion about whether...
Racial bias in AI,
no? But, well, that as well. There are so many things to talk about, but really the whole idea that now with the amount of information accessible, the whole sci-fi thing that there's been for years about machines becoming more intelligent than people could actually happen. No? The other day they were saying one of the godfathers of like AI that was warning about the dangers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and saying that he put the British government as an example of a less intelligent being, designing something that is more intelligent than them, and the dangers of that, which is fair enough. But anyway, that's for a different podcast.
Well, no, I mean, actually, I want to talk about that a little bit, because that would be more in our summing up part about AI in general. Because as you do know by now, this was devised, the loose structure here was devised by ChatGPT, and what would make an interesting podcast. If you like this podcast, it's because we can say the human intersection made entertaining. If you didn't like it,
definitely,
it just shows how terrible AI is. So it's a win-win for us, essentially.
Certainly.
But no, this is called a black box theory, that you can design it, but you don't know what's going to happen. And you know, linked to that, people like Elon Musk and this guy and other people wrote an open letter. They wrote an open letter saying they should pause the development of AI until their safeguards. Now, you have something to say about that, I do know, but I want to add though that this is good, because first of all, I mean, there are cases I think already where they don't really know how it works. There could be bad faith actors like Putin in Russia, for example, who could give what they call sub goals, or the ability to create their own sub objectives to AI, where they actually define their own goals, and then they have some kind of sentience or even autonomy, which is something that's uncontrollable, as it is terrifying. But then again, America is a tech center, of course, with San Francisco and Silicon Valley, but they've always been late to the party when it comes to these things. And with AI and stuff like this, China is streets ahead. And if the Americans don't work on it, then the Chinese would probably do it anyway. So it's something that's fraught with difficulties, this drive to control it and contain it. But tell me, what about you? What are your reservations about this open letter, or your criticisms of it?
Well, no, the thing is that he's basically, like, for example, Musk, developing their own version. So it was a bit rich of them to ask them to stop. Like, I'm not sure to what extent it was a genuine concern.
Yeah, but let me just add the caveat that if it's something designed by him, it probably worked for 5 seconds before exploding.
Yeah, that is true. But I mean, at the time, it was like, yeah, don't let them develop any further, you know, because we want to do something similar. But there are other voices, like this person I was talking to you about before, that were involved in the development and have raised like concerns. But it's more to do with like legislation. I think it was in the Spanish news last night about the EU looking at different categories of things that AI is involved in and rating them by how risky they were.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very mild step, and I'm not sure to what extent it's really that thorough, because, for example, like image generation was rated low risk, and I think that's a massive mistake, because we already see how, lots of images to do with history are being generated that have nothing to do with what places look like in those periods.
You mean like Popio, the Pope version of Coolio with the jacket?
But not just that, you know, even things in the past where it's generate an image about a Roman emperor and...
Well, even Amnesty International got in trouble because, in fact, some images they used for a report on Ukraine, which was also criticized for what was inside the report, but the photographs were taken from an AI generator. They weren't real photographs. So, you know, even if the report was good, which it wasn't by all accounts, you can't just afford, if you're a big human rights organization, to have that doubt of credibility around you if you're using AI images. So even sometimes AI can generate problems, but also people just using them stupidly will also create problems for them as well.
There was something about a university where there had been a mass shooting and they used GPT to come up with an email to, express the sympathy to people. I mean, it's just stupid.
I think that works if it's like, you know, Ryanair lost my luggage. I'm slightly annoyed, but I want to be polite. Draft a letter.
Yeah, fair enough.
But for a human tragedy, exactly. it's bizarre.
In your own institution, I mean, it's just...
I guess the only defense you could say is like they're so it's such an extraordinary event, you just don't know how to vocalize it or put things into words. That's the only thing you could say for why they might have gone down that road, you know? But I don't know. But I think, you know...
just lazy, ultimately.
The BBC said it was like, we're on a train, hurtling down the tracks, and maybe in the future, the train will start making its own tracks, which is a metaphor about how we can lose control of this thing. It could affect 300 million jobs around the world, that they say that as well. You know, these are things we're probably aware of. If we're summing up here, my view of this is there's going to be these things, like, it's like a nuclear plant. Mostly fine, but then there's a Three Mile Island or a Chernobyl. So it's going to be like isolated things that are very, very serious. And then things where it's kind of cool because they can either solve processes or are involved in surgeries or whatever it is. However, you know, I just think most of it's going to be this really weird, empty, middle of the road world, because you probably have teenagers in the future with posters generated by AI art on their walls, listening to songs made by AI, and everything is empty and soulless and just kind of blah, you know, because they won't know any better. It's just like Bob Marley mixed with Chopin. Here it is, you know, and they listen to it. And that's probably what the future is to a certain extent, because we already see people taking photographs or AI photographs or paintings winning competitions. People are interested in seeing what, if this movie Star Wars directed by Wes Anderson, this is what it looks like as per the perspective of AI. So people are experimenting with it now for fun, but I think that it could become its own line of entertainment in the future, you know, which would obviously would be horrific for most right-thinking people. That's my vision of how it will be rolled out in the future.
Well, I mean, the only thing we can hope is that it's a fad, but the problem is how long is this fad going to last? And as you said before, for developments to do with science and advances for medicine, things like that. But then, you know, it could be positive. But then again, it always seems to be the humanities that suffer the most with these things, because on the one hand, people say, oh, this is a robot, you know, this is science and all this. Has nothing to do with like art, but then actually the first thing that suffers is, you know, art, because they decide to do fake art, fake writing, automatic translations.
We already said as well in the podcast, you'll have fake lawyers in New York or somebody who's passed the bar at least, you know.
Yes, I know. But at the end of the day, that's it's still a way of like a human, you know, ability that relies on like words, for example. So I say words, maybe we could say, is something that suffers greatly. And we're already seeing it with translation jobs. I mean, the amount of translation jobs that are done by AI, and, you know, I'm basically working on one at the moment, and I'm just having like such a laugh at how bad still they are, you know, these translations, that they get like two words and they just cannot understand context whatsoever. And clients and people keep thinking that it sort of saves time, and it just doesn't. Just a waste of time, really. That's my take. I'm angry again.
Great stuff. Well, thank you, ChatGPT 3.5. For this structure of the pod. We will be back in we'll have a couple of our interviews we're recording, one tomorrow and one next week, so this episode will be sandwiched between two interviews with real people. So that's something to look forward to for future episodes of the People Will Talk podcast. So from this converted rubbish dump, which is now a nice park, thank you for listening.
Bye.
Good luck.